So today's daf from Masechet Ketuvot, brought to you from Yerushalayim, Ir HaKodesh, Daf Tzadik Chet. We're holding at the Mishnah on Daf Tzadik Zayin, Amud Beit, and we are going to begin with Doc's introduction. As promised yesterday, we had to do that because basically we only get people coming in the morning because they want to hear that famous introduction to the Mishnah. So go for it, Doc.
Zokta Helika Mishnah.
Amazing. Well worth the wait. Whew. Those of you who were unable to turn off your computer last night simply because of the anxiety of maybe missing, it was well worth the wait. Okay, so we're holding now. Machraket uvata o miktzata. So we're at the Mishnah, and it's Adi Zayin Amud Beit. We've been talking about the way that a woman is allowed to make her own cell, and we had the machlokes, remember, in yesterday's sugya, according to the Tanna Kamma. There's not even, if she's selling a ksuva, there's not even a need for her to go to Beis Din. According to Rabbi Shimon, it's only where she's selling for mizonot. We're over there, it's an emergency, so to speak. I mean, we can't have her go back to court every single time that she wants to eat and wait until a court decides it's going to hear the case. That's ridiculous. So there, if it's mizonot, everybody agrees. But if it's for the ketuvah, Rabbi Shimon says she's going to have to go to court to get for the ketuvah. Yesterday, we had, remember, two different approaches as to why we would allow her. According to the Tanna Kamma, what would be the reason that this is a special case in which a woman is allowed even for the mizon, for the ketuvah to sell outside of court as opposed to any other typical balchov. So we had two possible approaches. We had the approach of chen, and this would be itself a submachlokas between Rashi and Tosus. Remember, is the chen that the woman should be richer and that men should be attracted to taking them after a divorce or after the death of a husband for a second marriage? Or is the idea to make the collection easier, which is Rashi's approach, and therefore women will find the institution of marriage more attractive, chen in the institution, and will be willing to give themselves over for marriage, which is not a simple thing. So, okay, now comes along our Mishnah, and remember that we had already brought up this Mishnah, Zakasha and Ula, and there were two different ways of learning the Mishnah, as we'll see. Let's start at the beginning. An almana goes ahead, and she sells either her entire ksuva, or she sells just part of the ksuva. Or maybe she takes her ksuva and gives it as a mashkan for a loan so that she would be able to get money out of her ksuva, whether it's the whole thing or whether it's part of the ksuva. Or maybe she gave away her ksuva as a gift, or maybe part of her ksuva as a gift. Well, once that's the situation, then lo timkor ela bivet din. Now, this is telling us a new halacha, and that is that it's only, let's say if we were going, according to Rabbi Shimon, then this makes perfectly good sense, because whether she is sold the entire ksuva or part of the ketuvah, since Rabbi Shimon holds that you're only allowed to sell outside of Beit Din if you are collecting your own mizonos, and therefore we don't expect you to go to court. Therefore, since Rabbi Shimon also holds that once she sells even part of her ksuvah, she loses the schus to mizonos, as we've discussed in the past, and that's Rabbi Shimon's shita. So whether it was partial or whether it was complete, according to Rabbi Shimon, the meaning is she's lost her mezainis. Once she loses her mezainis, she can no longer sell anything except the Beis Din. So this is an extension of the shita that we heard in the previous Mishnah, because it's adding a new halacha, that even where she utilized her ksuva to give it as a mashkan, so that she had made this particular field an apotiki for her ketuva. Remember, apotiki is the Greek word that became in Hebrew apotehei koi. The collection should come only from this particular field. She uses that and she said, well, I have a right to this collection. I'm giving you that right if you lend me money. So in any event, even if it was partial, it's over. She no longer gets any mizonot. Mashenking, the Chachomim say, that's not so. She can sell gradually to collect her tuva. Maybe 4 pieces, 5 pieces, I don't care. But so long as she did not collect her entire ksuva, she still has that right to be able to get mizonot, and she can be mocheret lemizonot, shelo bebeit din. So basically, what's happening over here is that, first of all, they're saying, we do not need a bezdin to sell a ksuva. And furthermore, they're arguing on the new issue of this Mishnah, namely that even if a woman has collected part of her ksuva or mortgaged part of her ksuva, she has a right to continue getting mizonot until the entire ketuva has been collected. So there's two different issues here between the shitas in the Mishnah. And as we said earlier, vikotevet lemizonot macharti, that it is an eitzah tova, that she should include an indication in the contract that it was sold for the mizonot, and that way she is going to be able to collect from Mishul Badim. And we had that whole discussion, why it's good for her to make it clear what it was sold for. The Grusha, Lotim Kor Alababitin. However, when it comes to what the halacha is of a Grusha, so then, remember, we just discussed this yesterday. So the Chachomim that we had in the Reish, the Mishnah we learned yesterday, who hold that she's allowed to sell outside of Beis Din, even for a ksuva, remember that we had the machlokas between Rabbi Yochanan and Ula. According to Rabbi Yochanan, it's because when the man writes her out that ksuva, he has in mind he does not want his wife to go through the embarrassment and disgrace of having to appear in court. So therefore, when it comes to a divorcee, he doesn't care. Remember, however, so that would be very good. Then we could learn the Mishnah, even according to those Chachamim. Mashenkin, we ask this as a kasha on Ula, remember? Ula, who says that the reason that she's allowed to be mocher is because of the fact that we wanted to make it easy, the way Rashi learned, that women should actually look at marriage as something that's worthwhile getting involved in. So according to Ula, why doesn't the Grusha also need to be able to show women that, listen, even if it ends in divorce, it's easy to get your ksuva out. What would be the difference if it's an Alman or a Grusha? And the only way we worked it out, according to Ula, is that this Mishnah must be going Aliba to Rabbi Shimon, who holds that even an almana has to go to Beis Din if she's going to take her ksuva. And certainly the same thing would be true on the case of the Grusha. So he doesn't really care that much about the issue of chayin. He cares more, apparently, Rabbi Shimon, about the question of takanat olam and to keep the real estate markets flowing freely. Okay. Ask the Gemara, okay, who is exactly the Tanakama over here who says that once you collect even part of your ksuva, you no longer can go ahead and collect your mizonos? And we said that this seems to be gufa, the machlokas between the Chachomim and the Tanakama, so that apparently the Tanakama says you lose your ability to collect, says the Gemara. It's Rabbi Shimon, because we learned in a brisa that if a woman is mocher, she's mocher ktuvata, or she gave her ktuva as a mashka, or she had a ktuva that was an apotiki, and she went ahead and she gave that apotiki for someone that she owed money to. In any of these cases, ein la mizonot, and this is the Tana that is Tam, this is Rabbi Meir. Some even have in the Brisa, the original Brisa, have the Girsa Divrei Rabbi Meir, and then it actually says that in the Brisa. Rabbi Shimon Aimer, Afa Pisha Lo Machra, Lo Mishkana Ktuvata, Ela Machzita, forget about the whole Ktuva. Even if she only had taken half of her Ktuva, either collected it or put it up as collateral, And whatever the situation was, that's it. Bam. She loses her right to mizonot. And so therefore, the Tanakhama over here, who said precisely those words, is apparently following that sheet, or is Rabbi Shimon himself. Wait a minute. The holding of the ketuvah, remember, back at the beginning of the Masechet, we either actually learned out ketuvah, or we said we have a smichus, or the pasuk in the Torah, that says that kesev, in the cases where we were talking about basing it on rape, or on the pitui, so kesev yitain kimoar habetulot. We called the kesev of the ketuvah the amount which is given for the normal mohar, that's the dowry of a betula. So now, when Rabbi Shimon says over here that when she is still owed some of that kesev, it doesn't come under the idea of the kesev kemohar betulot any longer. It's either all or nothing. So if she is no longer owed her matayim of the petula, she collected some of it, so then we don't view whatever is left as the entire kesef. And apparently what you're saying is that that's what Rabbi Shimon holds. Look, it's no longer, she's no longer owed her ketuvah because she's not owed the entire ketuvah. Whereas the Rabbanon hold, even miktsat kesef is considered to be kol kesef. Now, look, that seems to revolve around a general principle. When we define a certain quantity, is that quantity defined holistically? This is the quantity, anything else is not? Or is it just not, has no qualitative elements to it? It's entirely quantitative, and therefore whatever is left is left. Now, this is an abstraction, an extreme abstraction, because we can apply this even to the extent that a woman remains a virgin. Is that completely a virgin? Partially a virgin? Now, I know you guys are saying, you know, that's like saying, is she partially pregnant? But it's not true. As we've seen before, virginity is actually measured in different ways. So we start off with a little girl who, as the Gemara puts it, has a nice, solid barrier to intercourse, which consists of a tight vagina and a hymen, and it's very difficult to penetrate. But once she becomes already 12 and a half years old, so she's a bogeris, then she's got a more flexible vagina and a thinner hymen. And therefore, she's sort of a betula, but not completely a betula. And then there's the quality of a betula, an untouched, in terms of sex, an untouched woman. And that issue is something completely different, because you could have a woman who retains all physical signs of her betulim, but she has had sexual connection. Maybe it's been anal and therefore hasn't affected any betulim. But those Japanese that want to pay that extra money for the geisha who is a betula are not going to like a partially used geisha, right? We can even ask Akiva about this, who is a bucky, because of the diary of a geisha produced by his brother. So he knows everything about that, I'm assuming. Well, maybe he's kept out of it a bit. But anyway, so this machlokas actually is a contradiction to the machlokas that we have over here between Rabbi Shimon and the Chachom. Surprisingly, we have a reversal of shitot. Because if you're telling me that according to Rabbi Shimon, quantity has qualitative aspects in the sense that it's all or nothing as defined. So then, and Rabbi Meir says the opposite, that we say anything that's left is still the kesef. Then that should mean anything that's left of the betulim are still betulim. But when it comes to the question, where do we care about the betulim? The Kohen Gadol. So the Kohen Gadol has to marry a betula. Now we have this machlokas as to what constitutes a betula. And there, surprisingly, we have exactly the opposite way of looking at it. Rabbi Meir and Rabbi Shimon reverse their shitas when it comes to this idea of the betula. Where is that? The time. Who isha bivetuleha? Kohen Gadol has to marry a woman who is a betula. So Rabbi Meir says, well, that means once she's 12 and a half years old, it's not a total betulah, and therefore it's no betulah at all. What? But Rabbi Meir over here was the one who said that if there's anything still owed, then that's considered to be kesef kemoar. Coincidentally, habetulot, which has nothing to do with it. So when it comes to the question over there, he says just the opposite, that if there's any little bit that's taken away, then she's no longer betulah. Whereas over here, if there's any little bit that's left, then she ought to be considered a betulah. And Dafka Rabbi Lozer and Rabbi Shimon of all people, Rabbi Shimon over there says, it doesn't matter, even if she's a Bogeris and she's 12 and a half years old, and she certainly is not fully a betulah, she still is enough of a betulah because any little bit of betulah is a betulah for a Kohen Gadol. Aha! And over here he said, any little bit of a ketuvah is not a ketuvah. Well, make up your mind. Answers the Gemara, you're absolutely right. But there's a good reason for why it is that we invert the normal shita that they have, Benogea, the Kohen Gadol. Because note, it doesn't say in the pasuk that he should marry a bitula. If it did, then Rabbi Shimon and Rabbi Meir would say exactly what they say over here. It uses a very strange language. It uses the word a woman within her bitulot. What in the world is that supposed to mean? Isha vivtuleha? Like, just say, v'hu bitula yikach. It's very clear that anybody that reads that pasuk is going to say, huh? So it's definitely saying something other than simply saying, marry a virgin. A woman who is in her virginity. How could she get in her virginity? That's exactly the point. So the question is, how do we understand that pasuk? Rabbi Meir says, if it would have just said betula. So like I say over here, kesef means any amount of that kesef. Betula means any amount of betuling. So even if she's only partially a betula, and therefore, if she has grown to be an old lady of 12 and a half year old, so then at that point, she's not fully a betula, that's still enough. But the problem is, instead of writing betula, it wrote betuleha. What is that? Betuleha means the way it was from the beginning. She needs all of those betulim left. Betuleha. So Dafka, the Torah, based on the way I normally would have understood it, I now need to understand that this way of phrasing it is telling me, do not learn like Rebbe Meir would normally learn. And in this case, she needs to be fully in a state of virginity, not a virgin. That's different. A virgin could be even 12 and a half years old, but in a state of virginity, that refers to the way she was made. Okay. So you need kula betulim. Now, in addition, we have something even more strange, and that is the betulim. She's inside of her betulim. Wow, what? Ah, inside? That sort of smacks of penetration, doesn't it? Inside. Oh, so since it says she's inside her betulim, that tells us that what we're talking about is penetration. How about if she wasn't penetrated, but she's not a betula sexually in the sense that she has had relationships, meaning that she had bia shaloka darka. And therefore, the pasuk is coming to tell me if that's her problem, that's not a problem for a Kohen Gadol. It's only a problem for a geisha. So shaloka darka, lo. That's the extra bivitula. Brilliant, beautiful limud of every last nuance. Of a pasuk, Rebbe Elazar, Rebbe Shimon, Savre, that because of the change in language, based on the way I normally would have understood it, it flips it. And therefore, Rebbe Shimon says like this, if it would have said just the word betula, so as I've already explained, that means the works, and therefore she would not be able to, this is like I say over here, that a little bit of the kesef, that's not the kesef. A little bit of betulim, that's not betulim. So if she's an old lady of 12 and a half, she's not a virgin. But the Torah didn't say she had to be a betula. It said that she could be betuleha. Why is it saying that? If there's any little bit of her betulim that are left. So here it flips it. And it says that she can marry a Kohen Gadol even if she's got a little bit of her betulim. And then when it says vivetulim, what is it coming to say? That's telling me she needs to be in a full state of betulim in terms of her innocence. That's something else. And therefore, that virginity, when we say somebody is a virgin in the sense of thinking, experience, naivety, that is something else, which means that she cannot have had any sexual connection to anyone, ben kedarka, ben shelo kedarka, even the extended meaning of betulim is included. So basically, the changes in the pasuk are going to affect the outcome based on your initial assumption. According to Rabbi Meir, Hudafka would have said that betulah would have meant, like he said in the Mishnah, any little bit. Now it comes to flip it. According to Rabbi Shimon, who says, no, it's all or nothing. Here it flips it and to say it doesn't need to be all or nothing. Excellent. Fine. Anyway, let's move on. So the question that we're talking about over here is miktsat ketuvah, the same as an entire ketuvah. So there was a woman who went ahead and grabbed, she was tofeset, a kasa de kaspa. So she had this beautiful silver Shabbos becher, and she grabbed it for her ksuvah. And apparently, she must have done this while her husband was still alive, because otherwise, she cannot be tofeset metaltalin. But whatever, there's different approaches. How was she able to do that? At what point of the dinim of collections? But anyway, she then comes along, and she says, look, I didn't collect my whole ksuvah yet, she says to the heirs. And I want you to start paying my grocery bill. And they say, get out of here. You already collected some of your ksuva, and we don't owe you anything. So they come to Rava, because it's a machlokas in the Mishnah. So they ask, do we still have to pay your grocery bill? And Rava says to the Yatomim, you better go out there and pay that bill. Nobody is worried about this sheet of Rabbi Shimon in the Mishnah over here, who says no miktsat kesev is not considered to be kola kesev. We do not paskin like that. We paskin like Rabbi Meir, even if part of the ketuvah is still, oh, sorry, she never collected the ketuvah, and you have a right to go ahead, and you have no right to go ahead and to cancel her mezonos. Now, they sent a shaila. Rabba sends a shaila to, and he was bereid Rabba, to Rav Yosef. So he wanted to know what's the din. The Mishnah says she can sell extrajudicial, right? Now remember that extrajudicially, as the Rishonim explained, does not mean that she jumps to a conclusion about what something is worth. She still needs to have an expert assessment. She just does not need any type of act of bezdin to allow her to be terefet, so there's no tirfar or anything like that. Okay, that's fine. The question is, what about the other deals? What about a shvua? If she is selling shelo bebeitin, does she need to make a shvua to the yitomim that she did not get more than the assessment was? Because she's selling privately, right? We don't really know what's going on. So we understand that the assessment was, you sold what it was that was necessary to sell for the, according to the assessor, $200 worth for your ksuva. But we don't really know how much money passed into your hands. Maybe the guy offered you more money, you know? So would they have to swear for that or not? Now, don't confuse this with the regular halacha that a woman always would have to swear, because there we're talking about a completely different issue over there. We're talking about swearing that our father didn't give you a safe deposit box, right? The law advocates, sorry. That's what we're talking about over here. Here we're talking about a completely different issue, where normally when something is done in Besdin, so then we understand it's all done up in public. The auction for the property is public. We know exactly how much money was paid. I understand that. But in cases where people, which we've had cases, apotropos, the people that have control of other people's money, we generally will make them swear that they did not take more money than they were allowed to take, right? So what would be the din? Does she need a shvua or not? So obviously, the halacha that you never collect from Yesomim without that, of course, was machlokas, whether they meant after Yesomim Ketanim or whether we meant even Gedolim that we discussed fairly recently. But all of that is referring to a totally different sugya. Do not confuse it with this. And that is the Lo'at V'Zei Tzrori. This is standard shvua for getting money in private. Says Rabbi Yosef, you guys that are asking about a shvua, don't you think that you should have asked a more fundamental question, which would have actually defined that for you? Do we need an actual auction the way that we use in Besdin? We have to put ads into the New York Times. You take bids and all of these things are public. That's what you should have asked, because in that event, she wouldn't need to make a shvua. And if it's not that event that she could actually sell privately, then she wouldn't need to make a shvua. So you should have gone for the underlying principle. I'm wondering, why did you ask directly about a shvua and not about hachraza? Omar Lay, Surabba Barova said to Rav Yosef, I'll tell you why. Because I knew the answer to that. Okay, because Rabbi Zera quoted Rabbi Nachman as saying that in the event that Almana, what she went ahead and did is she decided she doesn't want the cash. She's got plenty of cash. She's got a good job. What she wants is the property. So she goes out and she takes the land for herself based on the appraisal. Why should I sell it to somebody else and take the money and then go buy land? That's crazy. I'll take the land directly and say somebody else could have bought it. So I'm going to take it. Said Rav Nachman over there that if she does that, she has done nothing. She is not considered to be in legal ownership of that property. And if afterwards the Yesomim come along and say, will you get the heck out of our property? No, I took this property from my ksuva. We'll pay you for the ksuva and get out of here, because there was no kinyan on the property. So lost of a loklum. Now, let me explain this to you, said Rabba, why it was clear to me that there was no hakraza, because what's Rabbi Zera's case? Where what? She actually made a public auction and then she took it for herself. Kineged, the highest bid. So everybody's bidding. They bid up the price of the property. She says, okay, then that establishes the market value. Whatever it was, I'm going to match it and I'm going to take it. Is that the case? So why lo hastava lo klum? It's ridiculous. What we're going to say, that Shibadavka should sell it to someone else? We have a completely clear public estimation about the property. So how could Rav Zera have said lo hastava lo klum? So clearly, we got to be talking about where there was no hakraza, and Rabbi Zera is saying that because of that, she can't keep it for herself. Very suspicious, because how do we know? But that's only because she took it for herself. La'atzma, there Rabbi Zera is saying, lo hastava lo klum. But suppose she had sold it to someone else privately without a public auction. So then Rabbi Zera wouldn't have had a problem with that. And we would have said, Masha Asta, Asta. So that means she does not require Achraza. That's why I didn't ask about Achraza. So now I want to know, okay, what about a Shvua if it's done in private? Says Gemara, sorry, but you misunderstand. The issue here is not the difference between taking it herself in terms of having established accurately the value necessary. Really, Rabbi Zera could be talking about even where there was a public auction. And she went ahead and said, okay, I'm matching that offer, because that offer happens to be exactly what Mike Silva was worth. We got an offer for 200 mana. I'm taking the 200 mana. By the way, there's a machlokas Rashi and Tosfos, whether the issue over here in all of these cases is the Ikar HaKsuva, and now she's coming back to collect again when it says Miksas Ktuvata. Could be even the entire Iker Ketuvah, and she's coming back to collect the Tosefet, or according to Rashi, even initially, Mikset Ketuvata meant $10,000, and her Ketuvah with the Tosefet was $20,000. Okay, that's a side point. But in any event, over here, it could very well be that she matched up the value of what it was to the highest bid, okay? But what we say to her is, hey, lady, man shamlich, who, now listen, the language is weird because, and this, the Rishonim point out, the Ritva and the Ran actually argue on Rashi because of this, and the Psak is really not like this, according to many Peskim. But Rashi understands that it's a loose use of the word sham. Normally, sham means assessment. Shuma is assessment. We're using it loosely because when a court goes ahead and assesses something, the next step is that it gives it, according to that assessment, to the person. So what we're saying to her really is, according to Rashi, who gave it to you? I don't understand. A kinyan is not a one-way act. A kinyan is always someone giving over and somebody accepting. So in the event that you would have sold it to someone else, you would be acting as the shliach for the yatomim, and you would be handing it over to them. But who handed it over to you? And therefore, there was really no act of kinyan on it. And because of that, they could say, we want it back, and take money instead, because you never established ownership. That's how Rashi learns it. The other Rishonim who don't like the use of the word sham to mean that, what they say is, well, wherever your intent was to take it for yourself, the people who estimate it, they don't really give an honest estimation. I mean, imagine this scene. You know, we're having over there the big auction. Say, how much is she owed? She's owed $10,416. Okay. $10,001, $10,002, $10,400, $10,416 sold to American. Anyway, so what happens over there? We don't really believe it because it's not a decent shuma. That's the way that the other Rishonim understand. There's other explanations as well. But we'll stick with Rashi again. We're going through it on a simple level. And that's what we're talking about. We don't, according to Rashi, we don't consider her to be a legal owner because there was never any legal kinyan. Because we have exactly that issue. Now, I really think that Gereshi has to appear for this piece. It's one of the few places in the Gemara where Gereshi becomes part of the daf. And this was a case. Behind, there was a guy, the Afkidu Gabe, Kista de Yatme. So what we gave him, now here's Rashi's shot, is that there's actually the other Gersis Sita de Yatme, which means coral, says Rashi. And he writes that word, coral. So now this is talking about a Grusha, Gershi, coral. And therefore she went ahead and she took the coral. There you go. We always knew we would find the mucker, etc. So she went ahead and, but actually there was no woman in this case, but it's okay. It's close, right? So a guy gave a pikadon to someone. And it was this, according to Rashi, maybe it was animal feed, if it's kisto, or it was coral, if it's ksita. And they went to have it actually appraised. And what happened was that the father of these guys owed him money, right? So he said, well, I was owed $400 by your father. And guess what? The assessment came in at exactly $400. And so I took it. Now, then it went up. Okay. So at this point, as we know, Gersh is always going up. And a few months later, the 400 was worth 600. Constant growth. More value. Now it's come b'shitmea. So they go and they come to Rav Ami. And where he went, us lakame means this guy himself. They said, listen, you took Gershi for 600 and you were only owed 400. So, okay. So he comes to Rav Ami and he said, but it went up in my rishus, because I already had it evaluated at the 400. Omar lay, and Rav Ami said to him, man sham lach. Again, the same machlokas. Who gave it to you? You can't just arbitrarily say, okay, now it's mine. There was no best thing that gave it over to you, or the other pshat is, how do we trust that kind of shuma? And since there was no sham lach, it never belonged to you. So even if you hadn't it hadn't gone up in price, they could still have demanded it back. And you wouldn't have been able to hold on to it if they were paying the money. So therefore, we no longer have a proof. Rabbi Bar Rava was claiming that I need to know what the din is about the Shvuah. And it turned out that Rava said, you need to know about Achrasa too. So now it turns out there were two issues that are left hanging, and therefore the Gemara Paskins. Halacha is yes, she does need to make a Shvuah. And secondly, she does not need to do a public auction. And of course, these two, according to many Paskim, are dependent one on the other. If she doesn't need to do a public auction, so then she needs a Shvuah because she's in a position of handling other people's money and it's too easy to get away with murder. And this brings us to a special moment to the poor man that came in second today after Doc. But we're happy to have him back. And Doc was feeling a little bit guilty, I got to tell you. So he's very happy to find Richie back in action. Go for it, Rich. So now we're going to talk about sales that were not according to the assessed value. So let's imagine a case like this. You've got this almana who is, when she got married, was a bitula. Her ketuvah was for 200, and she went ahead and she sold a field that was really only worth 100, and she managed to sell it for 200. I'm a poor widow. Don't you think you could give me a better deal? So now the question is, since she got more than the assessed value, who does that go to? Does it mean that she essentially got 200 and now she has no longer any claim? Or can she say, well, I only got the extra 100 by doing my poor widow act, you know? But the Yatomim, they would never have gotten that amount. So therefore, that's just extra that I picked up on the side. I want another 100. Can she say that? Well, how about if it went the other way? Suppose she sold property that was estimated value by the assessors. The assessors are three assessors, remember, and they're sort of like a Besdin of assessment, which has nothing to do with selling the Besdin, as we've explained. And this the Riff learns all along that we're talking about. Of course, she has to get it assessed by a Besdin of assessment. Anyway, so she sold 200 zuz, and she agreed to accept, and she sold it under the value. Only for 100 zuz. Well, in either way, it's all her ksuva. She's already gotten it. Because at this point, we believe the reason is that we tell her, look, you messed up the atonement. You took the 100 and you threw it in the garbage. You only are left with the other 100. That's your problem. It's not their problem. They gave you a parcel worth 200. You sold it wrongly. Why did you go sell it wrongly? Don't come back to us. And in the other case, where she's claiming, well, I only got 200 for it because of my poor widow act, doesn't matter. It's our property, and anything that it brought in, and therefore it paid you for your ketuvah. Now, suppose the other way around. The ketuvah was worth 100, so she was not a betula at the time that she got married, and she ends up selling the property on the wrong price, is what it appears to mean. She had a piece of property that was worth 101 zuz. She sells it for 100 zuz. It's okay, I got my property. But the truth is, she sold it for less than it was worth. What's the deal over there? Well, she had no right to sell more than her amount of the ketuvah, which was the 100. She took property that was worth more. Who gave her the right to sell a piece of land that was worth more than her ketuvah? She did have no right to do that. And therefore, anything that she sold is bottle in this case. Even if she says, listen, come on, I mean, the extra buck, I'm happy to pay that buck back, you know. I'll give it to the heirs. They should stop making me tsaros. I got rid of it, and this is going to be mocked, but on, you know how much I put into this to find a buyer. I'll pay you the buck. Doesn't matter. She had no right to do that sale, and therefore, she cannot. The whole thing is bought. We're going to see in a moment what this is based on. Reb Shimon ben Gamliel Lomer, no, not true. Actually, in the event that she would pay it back, that would be okay, because we're not going to cancel the sale because she got actually too much money. She's paying it back. That's not the issue. The issue only is that the Yatomim have a right to say, you took away a usable property from us, you know, and therefore it has to be a usable property. So unless there's going to be enough to be a usable property, and that would be, if we're talking about sadeh, meaning we're talking about something that was for grain, right? So if we're talking about that kind of thing, then it has to be at least an area of tish akavin in order to be valuable. Anything less than that, nobody is going to bother planting. So tish akavin, that means that if you have seeds, 9 kav worth of seeds, that this property can be effectively seeded and will grow from those 9 kav of seed, then that is considered to be an actual field. But less than that, absolutely not. So as the Rambam explains it in the Pirush HaMishnayos, as in many places, that a sa'ah is 6 kav. And as we know, a sa'ah, that is mentioned many times in the Mishnah, a beit sa'ah, 6 kav, equals land of 2,500 square amos. If you break that up, it means that 1 kav is 416 2/3 square amot. So therefore, what we're talking about over here is it's got to be enough of an extra piece that would equal 3,750 square amot, and then we'd cancel the sale because they can say that's a useful piece of land. We want that. Therefore, it says Reb Gamliel, okay, then they have a taina, but otherwise, if she's willing to pay the money, so what's the problem? Okay, then there's all kinds of other issues over here. What if they have a piece of land that's next to this land, so it would have been usable anyway? So then the question is over there, could they taina also? Well, again, take a simple situation. We don't have these additional meitzar issues. So if it's a field, fine. If it's a garden, vegetable garden, well, then obviously it could be a much smaller patch of ground. And over there, even if it's considered to be a mer chatzikav, is enough to be a useful garden. And the way Rabbi Akiva explains in various places is that even a quarter of a kav is considered to be a real vegetable garden. This we'll talk about in Bava Basra, but okay, the dinim of splitting things up between shutafim. There Rabbi Akiva says a quarter kav of land in which you could plant a quarter kav of seed is considered to be a garden. Okay, there we would say, I agree, said Shimon Gamliel. There they have a right to say, who gave you the right to sell a usable piece of land? Now, how about another case? Case number 3. She had a ketuva that was worth 400 sous. If we're talking about the Ikra ketuva, remember we had the case before that the Kohanim demand 400 zuz for themselves and the business back them up. Fine. So let's say that she was one of those, right? She's at 400 zuz ketuva, and she sells to different people. So she sells to 3 different people 100 zuz. And for a fourth one, she sells a little bit extra, where the last piece was worth 101. Ah, so now the question is the entire sale process canceled because she took too much property? Or do we view each sale as being a separate sale? The first 3 she had every right to, because those were all, in fact, the amount that was due her. It's only the last piece that was 101 for her right to collect only 100. So how do we look at it? The whole thing is kaput, or do we look at all of it good except for the last piece? Says the Mishnah, the last piece is batel, and up to the last piece, it's all correctly sold. Okay, so now let's go into the details. What is special about the second case where she sells a field that was worth 200 and she sells it for 100? Okay, so now we tell her, listen, you collected your ksuva because you were the one who messed it up, right? We gave you 200 zuz, officially appraised. This is worth 200. You went ahead. We, the heirs, say to her, we did our share. We gave you a piece of land that was assessed at the full value. Now you went ahead and you sell it for less. Is that our problem? That's your problem. So we tell her, in selling this property, you ruined it for yourself, right? But that means that you have to take the loss on yourself. But why, if we do it the other way around, does the gain not go to her? If she sold in the first case something worth 100 and she did her little poor little widow thing and she got 200 for it, then we say they get the extra. Now make up your mind. Is she acting for them or is she acting for herself? Is she acting for them? So then it's canceled. Why does she bear the loss? I mean, if she's acting for herself, then if she got a gain, she managed to get the gain herself. Tema ana arvachta. She could say, listen, I did my shtick. You still owe me half. And I took the 100 that you assess. And what I did with it is none of your darn business. Where's my other 100? Omer, Nachman, Omer, Rabba, Baravua. Ha! It's here in this Mishnah that Rebbe has managed to teach us a very important yesod. And this they all is known in yeshivas that have gone through the inevitable breakdown between the staff that raises the money and the people that teach the Torah. And in the end, the money always says, we want to put in our kid as the new Rosh Yeshiva, and so on. And in fact, Rebbe says, Hakol Bal Ma'od, everything goes to the guy who brings the money. Basically, they, this is a famous shtick. But anyway, the real meaning over here is that anybody that supplies money and lets you go out and do things with that money, that extra money that you get, it goes always to the one who supplied the money and not to the agent who's acting with the money. It's always basically the owner of the money. Kedetanya, hosifu lo achat yitera. Suppose you sent a shliach to buy something for you, you know, and the seller added in one extra unit of whatever it was you were buying. Then, according to Rabbi Yehuda, the shliach gets to keep the extra unit. And we view it as a gift that he was throwing in for the nice guy who was giving him the money and not for the guy who owed the money. Whereas Rabbi Yossi says, you split it. Now, wait a minute. How does this work? You split it. But what does this have to do with Rebbe said? It all goes to the guy who gives the money. No. Hold on a minute here. We're in the middle. Now, we have a contradiction because there's a braita where Rabbi Yossi says you don't split it. And hakol lebal hamaot. So now, is that a contradiction? Rabbi Yossi can't make up his mind? No. Omer Rami Bar Chama, you have to understand the situation. Lokash. The braita where Rabbi Yossi says we split it is talking about the type of thing that has a set value. A box of hummus. So you went ahead and you bought 100 boxes of hummus for the grocery store owner who sent you to the wholesaler. The wholesaler says, you're a really sweet guy. Here, take one for yourself. He doesn't say for yourself. He says, take one more. So that's the point. What did he mean? I really like you because you're cute, or I really like you because you're bringing me good business. Okay, so then if you bring me good business, he wants to give it to the guy who sold him, right? So that, since we don't know, Rabbi Yossi says, okay, so split it. You can take half and you give the other half to the guy. But in a case where it's something that doesn't have a set price. So a guy's going in and he's working out a deal. Property never has a set price. obviously, you get assessments, but as everybody knows, you know, the assessment by one guy is like, whoa, totally depends whether you're going doing it for tax purposes or you're doing it for sale purposes. I mean, the assessment comes in according to what you want, essentially, right? So those are things that don't have a set value. And the truth is, Rashi even includes things that today we would look at. What do you mean doesn't have a set price? Because in those days where you don't have a manufactured goods, you have handmade goods, obviously things don't have a set price. A guy makes you a suit. You're going to tell him how much it was. It was old Mr. Bornstein who made you the suit? Or was it this ridiculous place in Joburg that sells these crummy jackets for Prince of Wales students? Ah! So therefore, it's something that would not have a standard price. You can't say that it's a gift. So where he's giving extra, there it's definitely coming in at a different assessment. That doesn't matter. It all goes to the guy, says Rabbi Yossi, who provided the money, which means that when Rebbe wrote the Mishnah, he was basically saying that he's poskening like Rabbi Yossi. And that's the point. And therefore, what we're saying is the Rebbe Yehuda also says the whole thing basically is on something that he decides to sell a little bit cheaply. That's given to the person who sent it to you. Now, halacha, omer of papa, that indeed is halacha. Dover sheyesh lo kitzvah, if it's chumus, so then we split it. We're not sure who the gift was meant for. If it's a dover she'in lo kitzvah, then indeed we paskin like Rabbi Yossi. I don't understand. So what's he saying? I mean, he could have just said halacha Rabbi Yossi. Some say even you don't even need to say halacha Rabbi Yossi because there's a klal that wherever Rabbi Yossi is chelak and Rabbi Yehuda halacha Rabbi Yossi, and that we had before back in Erevin. So what's he telling us? He's telling us that the way that we explain the contradiction in Rabbi Yossi is correct. That's what he's telling us. And that what we thought was must be actually is. And therefore, we can paskin straight out. If I would have told you halacha Rabbi Yossi, you would have said, do you mean the way we explained it? So therefore, he says exactly what it was that we do. Now, the question is, suppose somebody tells a shliach, and here we're going to see how this reflects on our mission. Somebody tells a shliach, sell a chatzikur. A chatzikur is a letter. Sell me a chatzikur of land. Remember, we measure, this is something you got to get used to. We use volume measures for selling land, because what we're really talking about is the volume measure of seed that would be able to be planted in that land at standard seedings. Okay. So it's a weird way. We're not used to thinking of it that way, but if you consider it, it's a very effective way to sell agricultural land. So the guy says, sell me a letech, which is a half of a kur. And the guy went ahead and instead he sold double that amount. He sold a full kur. What's the halach? Is the shliach simply adding more? And therefore he did the shlichus on the first half of a kur, on the letech, and then he did something that he wasn't authorized to do. And that, of course, is canceled if they don't want to sell it. Or, now obviously, if the buyer says, get out of here, I didn't want to buy a half a quarter, obviously the buyer can say it's a mistake. But the question is, can the seller say it's a mistake, right? So is he considered to have done more than he had a right to? Or did he do everything wrong because he simply canceled his instructions that were given to him by the mishaleach? So he's a ma'avir. He's actually violating the instructions that he was told. And therefore, they didn't even get the letter. It's totally bottle. Omer of Yaakov min ha'aprikod, I've got a fantastic raya from the Mishnah in Me'ilah. Amazing raya. Listen to this. We know that the din of Me'ilah is only where you use hekdesh, which you didn't know was hekdesh, and you went ahead and thought you were giving chul. Now, one of the important ideas of Me'ilah is that even though normally, as Gavi will tell us, ein shliach v'dvar avera, but when it comes to Me'ilah, we learn out from a pasuk, yesh liach v'dvar avera. So now yesh liach would mean that if I tell somebody and he keeps to my instructions, take this money, go to the store and buy something with it for me, I'm the one who is mayal, not the shliach. If, however, he did something against my instructions on his own, then he's the one who's mayal because he's not my shliach. Now listen to this, dig this beautiful mission. A guy invites guests to the house. He says to his shliach, give every guest one portion of meat in the oven. It turns out in the end that all of that meat was kachim. Oh my God. But he didn't know that. Okay. So he says, you give every one of those guests one portion. The shliach goes ahead and he says, okay, take two. And the guests take three. So now it says, everybody was mayal. The first guy was mayal because he said, take one. The shliach is mayal because he gave out another one. And then all of these slobs that took three, they also were mayal on the third. Now, here's my point, says Rabbi Yaakov. If you understand that when a shliach does more than he was told to give one and he gives two. That on the first one, he's considered to be doing his job and it's not a total violation. That would explain why the balabayit was the first one to be mayal. Then the shliach on the second piece, on that he's mayal, and then the archim on the third piece are mayal. But if the shliach, if he does something different than his instructions by adding, is actually canceling the entire shlichut because he was going against the instructions, why is the balabayit mayal? Where's the shliach? Fantastic proof that when you add to your instructions, we don't view it as canceling the deal, but rather as two separate transactions. One of them, you exceeded your authority. The other one you did exactly, right? Beautiful. So balabayit amay ma'al, doesn't it say, beferish, the same Mishnah, ha-shliach sha'ashlichuto, if the shliach correctly did his shlichut, so then the balabayit is ma'al, because yesh shliach v'dvar avera. But if he didn't do his shlichut, then he's the only one that's well himself. So if he was not considered to be doing the shlichut, then how do we have all three being mayal? The balabayit shouldn't be mayal. So you see that adding to instructions is not called actually violating instructions. Look, I got to admit, it's ingenious, but it doesn't prove anything. Because, I mean, the case could easily be, you know, where the shliach comes out and he says, listen, everybody, the guy told me to give one piece. You're welcome to one piece. But, you know, he's a stingy guy. I would take two. And they end up taking three. So over there, he was mekayim the shlichus by saying to them, take the first piece from the balabayit. And therefore, maybe that's what it's talking about. The omer lo tluach hat midato shel balabayit. And then me, I'm offering you two. And they go ahead and they took three. And therefore, everyone had a separate shlichut. Now, how is all of this nogea? All of this is nogea, our Mishnah. Look at the Mishnah. Okay, what's the case in the Mishnah? Case two. The ksuva was worth 100, and she went ahead and she sold a piece of property worth 101 b'mana. So it says over here, the whole thing is bottom, according to the Tanakh. So, I mean, I'm assuming that means that she sold it. Now, this is a completely different interpretation of Mishnah than the one we had. We thought it meant that she sold the 101 for 100. No. What it means is, what we're trying to say, what it means is she sold 101 for 101. What? It says she sold it for 100. What's the matter with you? For 100 means for the purposes of her ksuva, which was 100. Doesn't mean that's what she sold it for, using the word for wrong. So bimana means in order to fulfill what was owed her as a mana. But she got the full price, right? So this has nothing to do with violating the price. So why is the whole thing canceled? Because she exceeded her authority. So what do you see from there? Exceeding your authority. That's the end of the whole thing. And therefore, since she was acting as a shliach for the Yatomim, therefore the whole thing is canceled. Let's see that inside. My lab is loving shava mona of a dinner for the full mona of a dinner. Why does it say it's in it for a mona? No, that means for the purposes of collecting the mona that's due to her. And then when the Mishnah says, even if she says, I'll give back the extra dinner. There wasn't an extra dinner, honey baby. According to what you're learning it, what was the extra dinner? It means that I'll give back the extra dinner that I made. Not that I'll give the extra dinner that I made. But how will I give it back? I'll give them back the land. I'll give them back one dinner worth of the land. That's the only part that's important. If the issue is exceeding your authority, who cares if she pays? That's not the point. She is saying, I'm going to give them back the land. Everybody's angry at me. What'd you take? 1.01 when you only had a right to one. You exceeded your authority. I didn't exceed my authority. Here's the land back. For God's sake, the same piece of land. Now leave me alone. No, you can't do that. Because there's mikra batel. That means that a shliach who goes there, not because he's causing any kind of loss, he gives the same amount of land by replacing it. Doesn't matter. He exceeded his authority and therefore canceled. There you go. Right there in our Mishnah. No. I mean, that's how you read it. I could read it that she sold 101 for 100. And it's talking about that she didn't get enough. But maybe if she had sold it for the right price, then we would say, she exceeded her authority, fine, but you don't cancel the whole thing because of that. There's just that extra bit. Okay. To be continued. But meanwhile, we caught up over here, Baruch Hashem, to the last word on the daf, and we're wishing you a Moadim L'Simcha, and don't forget the closing words of the Hoshana, which is Hoshia et Amecha. Uvarechet nachlatecha, ureim, 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 ureim v'nasem, ureim v'nasem, ad oin lom. See you all, Bezrat Hashem, tomorrow. Take care.